All right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin alongside Dommy Amazing. Dom, how are you?
I am in good spirits, even though I still have the plague carried over from last week. But in between bouts of spluttering, I will try and throw my thoughts out there into the world.
All right. Well, thoughts and prayers for a speedy recovery there. We are, of course, back to dive in today to the Merge episode from Survivor Edge of Extinction, and obviously a lot more than just a Merge vote to be getting to. We also saw Rick Devens re-enter the game from the nominal Edge of Extinction, the titular Edge of Extinction,
The eponymous Edge of Extinction?
Yes, that was what I was looking for. Thank you very much. A lot to be getting to along those lines
But first, instead of talking about what there was, we have to talk about what there wasn't, because longtime listeners will know that the longer the Previously On segment gets, the longer I have to listen to Colin complain about how long the Previously On segment is, which means that the historic first and historic first in this episode, where we had no Previously On segment whatsoever, this must have made your week. You must have been, I would say, grinning from ear to ear, but you don't seem like much of a grinner. Were you beaming? Were you thrilled?
I am currently doing something from ear to ear for sure, but this is a conflict for me here, Dom, because patrons of the podcast will remember maybe 3 or 4 days ago me announcing my official retirement from ever talking about the Previously On Survivor ever again, because people are tired of hearing me get into it. And then, of course, for the first time in Survivor history, there's just literally nothing to be seen here, and it's weird, right? Like, I never thought we would potentially even see the day that would come into play. But yes, to answer your question, to give a serious answer to your question, I am genuinely, yeah, thrilled, ecstatic, beaming, whatever words you want to use to describe them allotting the airtime to things that are going to be more important. And I furthermore think this is potentially a step in the right direction of being willing to give the audience credit, or maybe just finally understanding that the audience doesn't need such, I'm not going to say hand-holding necessarily, but the audience can easily hang with whatever you put in front of them. They, through context or whatever else you show that week, can generally figure out plenty of stuff, and they don't necessarily need to have seen it flagged up in the Previously On to know what's going on.
Well, I'm sure all of us are very glad that Stone Sonatus, or Sin Stone Artist, whichever you prefer, could really go both ways, was briefly summoned out of retirement. And I stress briefly there, just in case there was any doubt about that.
I'm back in retirement now. I'm done.
Good. You can go back to your rocking chair and have a much quieter life. But do you think that this was just a case of we literally don't have enough time in the episode for all of this? Or does cutting the Previously On segment just by itself make some kind of statement about the pacing of the episode and set up the big reveal that's coming shortly that much better?
I don't think it really is going to stand out to anyone who's not actively looking for it. I mean, maybe it is something that even casual fans are by now used to every episode, literally every single episode, beginning with Jeff, other than like season premieres, with Jeff saying Previously On Survivor. And it's weird to not have an episode start that way for the first time out of like 600 or so possible cases where that would be the beginning of the episode. But I would imagine it was, yeah, just a consideration of there is more interesting stuff that we want to show about the current goings on, and given that we are now entering a relatively fresh situation with the Merge on hand, even though they generally do give you some kind of setup for how the Merge dynamics are going to then play out, I think they made the decision, yeah, that a Previously On for the first time, I believe, in history was something we can just totally cut. And again, I'm totally happy about that. I hope that's a decision they go back to in the future.
Well, stay tuned on that front, I suppose. But as I said, we rush straight into that big reveal. Were you excited for this? Because Jeff certainly was. But I don't know if the casual fans at home or the less casual fans at home were sharing his excitement over all of this.
Just knowing since, like, I think pretty close to the day the news was broken about, like, the returnees that were going to be back on this season. I think it only took, like, a week or so for Redmond to then break the twist of the season and the details there. So it's been a long time that I've known at the merge, someone is going to come back in. So at least for me personally, this was not an exciting reveal, and to the point that I had to clarify which reveal you even meant, because neither of them was that exciting to me, but I would guess, yeah.
I don't mean the level of suspense or surprise around it, because obviously if you've been, if you haven't been living under a rock, the level of either of those things is approximately zero. I just mean the level of excitement. Like, were you amped up to see how all of this would actually transpire, or was it more of a sense of dread than anything else?
It was, I would say, curiosity about what it would be like now really seeing in practice the first phase of this. But to just quickly finish that last thought, I would imagine for most casual fans who were not inside Survivor readers, this was a pretty thrilling reveal. I know, obviously, it's not a surprise to them that the people who were voted out didn't end up just going to Ponderosa or on the pre-jury trip or wherever the casual fans think they go. But to see them coming in this week, was that something, I guess maybe the next time on Survivor flagged that up? Did they show that in the next time on Survivor?
They showed some gasps and hands over mouths and so on and so forth, but I don't think they hinted at any actual details. Okay. But that's, you're raising a good question, and ignore the hint of surprise in my voice, though, but where do the casual fans think these people go after they're voted out? Has there been any like scientific study on this?
I don't know. I would suspect plenty of them think they literally just get sent home right there, which I believe is what happens on like Australian Survivor and maybe other foreign versions of Survivor.
That they just get taken out back and shot or just left to fend for themselves in the wilderness?
I don't think they think it's that. I don't know who thinks it's that or would ever want it to be that, Dom.
I don't know how people think.
Hey, if you want to get people playing to win, that's the ultimate incentive, I suppose. I'm really not sure how much anything we're saying right now and what we're seeing right now is ultimately going to matter at the end of this season. And what I mean by that is this first round of Edge of Extinction is a nice way of kind of like dipping our toes into the water and getting us used to this concept. But I would guess that whether the second returnee in the finale and no matter what outcome they end up having there, the second round of someone entering the game and the way that plays out is going to be the lasting impression that all of us are left with years from now. And pretty much nothing that we're talking about at this point is going to be remembered come mid-May.
Right. And so all of this is essentially a sideshow. And for as much as we're talking about it now, because we have to, and because it's also the thing that just sticks most recently in our memories, by the time we get to whatever this ends up being, like final six, final five for the second one, that's going to be,
sure.
Yeah, that's just going to override everything else.
Right. And obviously, if that person goes on to win the game, that's going to be the overwhelming narrative about just this season as a whole from now until the end of time. But I still think even if they don't go on to win the game, seeing that in practice the second time around when it's so close to the end is going to be essentially the entirety of the way that the Edge of Extinction twist is judged.
And the only way that this phase might be remembered is if Rick is also the returnee in the second phase as well. And so there's like there's one continuous arc over the season.
He wins. If Rick parlays this into winning, I could see that being a big talking point for sure.
Sure. And do you think either of those outcomes is really still in play?
I think both of those outcomes are still in play.
Interesting. Because, we've said before that when you have a twist that is either unique or which is guaranteed to have some kind of warping effect on the season, it's hard to know how that's going to factor into the edit, and stay tuned for the edit zone if that's your kind of thing. But, like, if Rick gets voted out twice and comes back twice and goes on to win, like, there's no cookie cutter edit template for that, right? And Rick himself is not the type that you can shoehorn into any existing template, so you really have to just work with what you're given. And with that, I have no idea what that would even look like.
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be a long, long time, God willing, before we have kind of an established person who got eliminated, re-entered, and went on to win the game stereotypical edit.
Let's hope that that's never more than a one-off thing, if that.
Right. But I don't know. I mean, I think, honestly, like to kind of wrap up my thoughts, I suppose, or sum up my thoughts overall on this first cycle of Edge of Extinction, I, much like the entire pre-merge of this season, and as we'll get on to this merge episode overall, I was pleasantly surprised with how it's gone so far. It certainly, to this point, at the very least, has not been as intrusive, I guess I'll say, to the way that I view what Survivor just kind of fundamentally is. To have it be the person specifically, I think, who just kind of got swap screwed, as far as I can tell, and sat out for like 3 days and then got right back in, I think is a much easier pill to swallow. And that's why I think that second time around, especially if it's Joe, who spends whatever, however many days it ends up being, like 18 days or whatever, outside of the main game, and then potentially finds himself in the finals, that could be a lot tougher to handle in terms of not just completely cracking open the idea of what Survivor is.
Yeah, and let's get into how Jeff framed this, because he was clearly savoring the moment. He was very excited to be able to set all of this up and unleash the ultimate blindside on the contestants here. And he'd been waiting a long time, not too long though, because people this week were unearthing interviews that Jeff did back in 2005 or whenever about the Outcast twist, saying that it fundamentally altered the game and it was unfair on like an ideological level. And we were all having a nice chuckle over that. If Jeff ever believed that, and maybe it was all just for show, he clearly doesn't now, so we have to work with the Jeff here in 2019 rather than the identical looking Jeff, I'm sure, that we had back in 2005. But this Jeff right here is very excited for all of this, and he says that this is about to be an iconic moment. Firstly, I'm not sure who taught Jeff the word iconic, but I imagine that's going to be a recurring part of his lexicon from now on.
He's going to start stanning people.
And cancelling them just there on set, yeah. But
the tribe has cancelled you.
Right. But he doesn't get to decide what's iconic, right? That's up to the viewers, and the viewers are the ones who, in theory, indirectly write his check and pay his bills. So we'll leave it up to the audience to render their verdict on that. He elaborates on this by saying some of these moments take years to become iconic and others are iconic immediately. What exactly takes years to become iconic? I've been puzzling over this since I saw the episode and I still haven't figured it out.
Yeah, I mean, it is a good question. I think there is certainly like the for super fans, I think there are plenty of things that take kind of years to catch on or times change. And when you keep up with the things that have happened off the island or take into consideration things that played out in future seasons, certain things in retrospect become a lot more interesting. Or, for instance, like the funny 115 kind of style stuff where Michelle Yee falling off the platform wasn't the talk around the water cooler the day after the episode, but that's now like one of the most memorable things about the entirety of Survivor Fiji, frankly, for a lot of people. So, yeah, you are right, though, that Jeff putting it in terms of it's a frequent thing that happens where after given some years to mature, certain things in Survivor take on this massive legacy that wasn't initially there. You are right. I can't come up with pretty much anything that fits that mold.
Mm-hmm.
Has Reddit come up with anything? There's got to be something out there.
I'm sure they have. If someone unearths something of value from Reddit, please let me know so I don't have to go searching for it myself. But we'll leave that door open for now. As it happens, Rick is going to be the one entering the game again. And Wentworth has a confessional on this, which it turns out was actually a confessional about something else. And I'll let you give the receipts here because I'm not sure how this all came together.
So I believe I saw this from Wentworth tweeting it out herself, which is, for my money, pretty heroic for a three-time player to be essentially firing shots almost at CBS in terms of the way that they portrayed this take from her, where she, yeah, I think it was, again, someone on Reddit like pieced together the clips of her from the episode giving the confessional about how when I saw Devins was the one who came back, I thought, oh, hell no, and does the like Macaulay Culkin Home Alone hands on cheeks face. And someone on Reddit like clipped that together with, I think it must have been a secret scene that they released where it shows the actual context of her giving the oh, hell no line. And in the full version, it's her talking about Chris, Reem, and Keith coming around the corner, and Devins is one of the only people not listed about the people she didn't want to see. So loved seeing that from Kelly about her essentially calling out the editors for completely misrepresenting what she was trying to get at. Although I'm sure for not the first time this has happened to someone with as much experience on Survivor as Kelly.
Anything else you want? Any other praise you want to lavish while we're on the subject?
No, I genuinely did just like the willingness to put that out there
You didn't just like it. You thought it was heroic. And look, I thought the Fab Five on Queer Eye collectively shared the trophy for the most eyebrow-raising use of hero to describe anyone. But I think that's just been awarded to you. I think you've knocked them off their podium.
Dom, it's iconic. And if you don't stan it, you are canceled.
Okay, I'll bear that in mind.
Yeah. What did you think during that confessional of on her lower third, it gave her name, Kelly, and then said next to that, one immunity idol. For the first time in Survivor history, they are now tracking hidden immunity idols for us on people's confessionals. And I saw actually the backstory on this on Twitter as well, to go back to that well for like the third time in 20 minutes, where someone literally just tweeted at Jeff Probst, hey, you guys should do that. Just let us know who has the hidden immunity idols in some kind of graphic form. And he tweeted back a couple weeks ago, love the idea, and then followed up on it right the day this episode aired by responding to the guy, hey, that's going to be in tonight's episode. Make sure you tell all your friends I'm the one who came up with that. So what did you think of this, Don?
Yeah, I it's not even a backstory. It's just the story, right? If you were on Twitter, you saw this play out in real time. And I wasn't sure how long this would take to go into effect. I don't know how these things usually work, but maybe I wasn't giving them enough credit, because I thought, okay, Jeff has put that idea in the back of his mind, and maybe we'll see that come into play for 39, and at a stretch towards the end of this season, if they have time and they're willing to experiment, it would come up. And then just 3 days later, on the next episode, we see this go into action. So what does that say about the turnover time with the editing of the episodes? Like, are they just frantically putting all of this together last minute? Is it not to have to put the penny in the swear jar for the genius again, but is it a kind of like semi-real time thing where the episode, let's say, that's coming up this Wednesday is still being edited, and so they can take into account the reception for episodes prior to this? Or what do you think is going on there?
So I would imagine most of it is fully edited quite a ways in advance, and they are able to call audibles like this when it's some minor tweak, like changing the letters on a lower third graphic. That is immensely easy to fix. The annoying part is having to like render the entire episode again and then re-export it. But that takes 30 seconds to change it from second chance to one immunity idol. I would not guess that it is anything close to the genius. And I would also not guess, and I think it's obviously the case, that it is not anything like they have to have these episodes submitted months in advance. I think there is plenty of wiggle room, ding the bell, for minor tweaks, but I don't think they're making any massive changes based on like audience reaction to the episode from last week.
Yeah, no large implications here, I think, but I worry now that Jeff maybe doesn't know what he's got himself into. He may have opened the floodgates where now everyone on Twitter thinks that they can see, you know, they can be the change they want to see in the world and just make their mark on Survivor as a franchise by just tweeting at him. And so he's going to be inundated with just completely asinine requests for changes to make to the show. And this actually was a very good idea, and I'm surprised, as Jeff seemed to be too, that they hadn't thought of it and implemented it themselves many years ago. But this is the needle in the haystack. This is the golden nugget in whatever metaphor you want to use for Twitter, right? So right. I worry that, you know, this is, I'm not sure this is going to be worth the price of admission, ultimately.
Well, I can still hold out hope, Dom, that even though he hasn't had a confessional in like 3 weeks, the next time War Dog pops up on the screen, it's just going to stay Law Student, because I've been heard and they've changed it. And it's at least doable.
They're tipping their cap to you.
Yeah. And I guess worth mentioning, because everything always goes back to the genius, that is certainly something there is plenty of on there from season one, episode one, all the way through. And granted, those are much more complicated games than Survivor is. But the genius is very big on using graphics and pictures of people's faces and putting little circles around who's working with whom to help the audience follow along with the crazy action going on the screen. Do you think we could potentially see this even evolve, Dom, and see more things along these lines to kind of aid the audience with some of the more complicated scenarios?
We have seen tentative steps in that direction. So when there's a complicated idol hunt going on, and obviously the audience can't be expected to see the sliver of blue cotton that's hanging from a tree or something, they often make that flash on the screen, or if they're trying to poke fun at someone's inability to find that, then they'll make it flash, or they'll do something creative to make that more obvious. So they can definitely follow that path and experiment more with that, and I hope they do. But that is the one genius mention for the year. I'm impressed we made it, I guess, 3 months before that, but we'll see you all again in 2020.
Yeah, there we go. So let's get into this merge situation now, where right away we get back to this merge beach and Rick is just putting his bag away and takes a peek in and notices something that was not there before. He sneaks off and finds what appears to be a full-blown hidden immunity idol. It turns out it is an idol that comes in two pieces, and he has to pick someone to share this idol with, and it's not valid until after this next vote. But Dom, what do you think about, for what I think is the first time in history, someone just being literally gifted an advantage within the game?
I don't actually hate it. I hate it less than I expected to, and I'm not sure why. So if you can tell me why I think that, that would be much appreciated.
I think I hate it less than I expected to as well, because of the circumstances where if you're going to have this kind of thing happen, I do understand the argument for let's give it to the person who's already been eliminated once, has spent at least a little time out of the political atmosphere of what's going on within the main game. And at the very least, if they can't make it through this first round, if everyone decides that they're better off just getting rid of them immediately, it's not a complete freebie. Like, we at least have some sort of plausible deniability that we are not putting this on just super easy mode and throwing in that caveat. And likewise, I think that splitting it in two essentially exists for that same purpose, which is to make it look like it's less of a freebie than it actually is.
Yeah, we've had similar things come up in similar games before, where someone comes back into the game and gets a free week for immunity or some stepping stone on the route to power, with the understanding that they were voted out runs for a reason, it would be very obvious and easy, and therefore probably bad TV as well, to just vote them out again. So we need to give them a little nudge to help them along their way. And I don't mind that, honestly. If it goes back to our previous discussions about the Edge of Extinction concept, where the unfairness of whatever this is already bundled up in that to begin with. And once you take that step, this is perfectly consistent with that. And if you have issues with it, then I think your issues are with the larger thing that's going on here, rather than Devon's getting a conditional half of an idol, which we don't even know how it's going to work yet.
Right. And I think another major element for me is, at this point in the post-Ben Dreebergen era, who really cares anymore? Like, clearly all bets are off as far as I'm concerned. Like, advantages and magic powers from this point for the rest of time in Survivor going forward can just fall from the sky and into anyone's bag. And I don't think that now that it's been a couple years since that has essentially been the case, it can really shake me to nearly the same degree it once did. And why I think Heroes, Healers, Hustlers will always trigger me so hard, because that to me was where it just got smashed completely wide open.
All of the people who threatened to stop watching when that happened and actually followed through have stopped watching, right? And the rest of us have shown that, you know, our actions maybe don't match our words. We're not putting our money where our mouths are.
I never said that. At what point did I ever say I'm going to stop watching this show?
No, I didn't say it's not all about you, Colin. I said the people out there who did say that. And there were many on Twitter on finale night for season 35. Those of among them who made it to season 38 have signaled what they're willing to put up with. And I don't think this is nearly as egregious as some of the stuff that possibly went on in that season or since then. So I'm actually okay with it, I think. And the way they did it here was kind of interesting, where he gets a time-limited advantage, but it's almost the opposite of the Chris Noble idol, where with that one, it had to be used within a few votes and then it would just expire. With this, it only becomes activated if you survive long enough to do it. And in this case, that time window is pretty narrow. You only have to make it through the first vote. But that merge vote is the craziest, most chaotic vote, the one where you always feel unsafe and where you really want that level of security. So I think it's nice in a way that you don't get that for this vote and you have to figure something out for yourself. But it also looks pretty bad if Rick just is the merge boot again, which you think would be the most natural option, and that twist never comes into play and only wastes even more screen time.
Right. One thing I thought was at least potentially interesting is when Rick wins the challenge and gets his buff and joins the tribe, Jeff says to the big group while they're still standing by the challenge, okay, Devins has a fresh start in this game, but that's all he has, which to me either seems deliberately misleading, or I genuinely think it is at least possible Jeff didn't know that that twist was going to be in play, or furthermore, they had not yet decided that that twist was going to be in play, and when Rick won it, it's at least possible to me that they decided to go for it.
I'm sure when Jeff has to sit down with the lawyers to justify that, it'll all look good, but maybe what they're going for here is, well, Devin's has an idol, but Rick, you know, I don't know if that's what they're going for, but yeah, that stood out to me too.
Yeah, so I would imagine it's Jeff just getting caught up in the moment, and I think honestly the most likely thing is Jeff knew Devins was going to be, or whoever re-entered was going to be given an idol, and just forgot about it and said something that he thought would sound good in the moment. I'm sure that happens to him all the time, but I do think it's at least possible that he did not know that was going on, or that production had not yet decided that was definitely going to happen.
But I don't think anyone listening to that, even if they were trying to read something into it, would interpret it as, okay, I have just been given official confirmation by Jeff that Rick doesn't have anything.
It just stands out when you know the following scene is Rick being handed an idol.
Yeah, but it's not any old idol, right? It's half of an idol that can become a full idol, but we have this co-wrong callback in play where you have to give half of it to someone else and then you get to pair them together. And in that case, you don't have to make... like, the two people who have them don't have to come together and find each other and come to some kind of agreement. In this case, Rick gets to give that other half to whoever he thinks he can work best with. He knows that's David. That's a safe choice. But I've seen some arguments that maybe you should be giving it to one of the leaders of either camp to try and ingratiate yourself, or because you're still in kind of a hostage situation, right? Where you don't get to, like, your own threat level isn't raised by this because they can just refuse to use their half of it at any time. But so, like, let's say he gives it to Kelly, for instance. Kelly can just refuse to use it if Rick is ever in the firing line, excuse me. So it doesn't actually give him that security unless she wants him to. So that's a pretty appealing offer he can make to her. But then he's basically put that one tool that he has face up, and so she knows how to nullify it whenever she wants to, and she knows that there's no, like, additional secret power to it or whatever that she needs to worry about. So I think I like what Rick did here. Just give it to the guy who you know is solid, hope that you both make it through this round, and if you do, you now have this secret weapon that the two of you can plan how to use most effectively.
Yeah, under different circumstances, I do think there is a potential argument to be made for taking a big swing with who you give the other half of this idol to. But in this spot, I would definitely agree that Rick sharing it with David is the fundamentally sound play, and potentially to the point that doing anything else would be like fancy play syndrome and be almost a blunder compared to the, like, Occam's razor straightforward play that is going, it's straightforward for a reason, essentially.
Yeah.
Right. So definitely liked that out of Devins. And even though obviously this vote doesn't go their way, you know, they're not on the main page with the big alliance and it doesn't look like their prospects, entering next week are the brightest in the game, it does still seem to you like Rick and David are going to be getting along and working closely going forward, even though we've started to see this Lesu group turn on each other?
Oh, I'm sure every single group in the game is going to turn on each other at some point, but if I had to name a duo that seems committed to it for the long haul, I would say David and Rick are a good bet. And also, we've had this thing which, in retrospect, maybe seems more important than it seemed at the time, where we had that discussion with the two of them saying, oh, well, I'll betray you at Final Four, don't worry about it. Just kind of jokingly acknowledge what they both know to be true. And I wonder, given that we got to see that, is that going to be something that we will have to speculate about going ahead? Like, will they both be in the game for long enough that the question of who gets to betray who... Hold on, who gets to betray whom? Whatever. Who has that privilege? That will actually be a relevant plot point here.
I forgot all about that, but yeah, that definitely is something that is worth noting, is the discussion we've already seen them have about that scenario and how it would go. Keep that in your back pocket, I think, for sure. But one other thing I was thinking about before we get too far off of just the idol that the two of them are now splitting is, and Rick getting it in the first place, is I don't know that this is going to necessarily be the only time in upcoming seasons that we have people re-enter the game. I think it's at least possible the Edge of Extinction or something of that nature comes back sooner rather than later, depending on how this season ends up going. And I do wonder now, though, if because future players will have seen Devin's handed an idol upon re-entering the game, it seems to me like in any future season where this sort of thing is in play, that person who re-enters has to have a massive target, even bigger than they ever otherwise would, just because of the possibility of that happening again, right? Of production saying they want to help out the person who's kind of facing this uphill battle.
And if you are that person and you don't get something, you'll feel screwed over because everyone else will assume you got something and you don't even have... So there's an additional level of scrutiny on you beyond the heightened attention already, and you don't even have anything to fend it off with. So I think they've set the baseline pretty high now and they can't ever really lower it again. So if you are scared of advantages just escalating in frequency and power over and over again, then this is just another step in that direction.
Right, and production may think, hey, if everyone's going to expect them to have a power and target them for having a power, we should at least give them a power so they could potentially do something cool to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so certainly if that does become something we see more of, could be an interesting kind of evolution of players trying to figure out how the producers are thinking and how to handle these people re-entering. I don't think that's a crazy kind of timeline to consider, this sort of thing becoming like I don't mean regular thing, like the next kind of fire challenge, but certainly something like a Redemption Island that they go back to more than once. But Dom, what do you think about Jeff making it clear to everyone as soon as Rick has re-entered the game that this is not the end of Edge of Extinction, and from now on, everyone who gets voted out has the opportunity to go there, and you will get a chance to compete again to earn your way back into the game? How do you feel like that changes things for these players now as they've freshly hit this merge?
Do you mean how do I feel about Jeff telling them about it rather than keeping that secret, or what are you going for there?
I get what I'm getting at is, do you feel like now that if you're playing a game of Survivor, knowing roughly how the Edge of Extinction twist works now that you've seen it once and knowing this is going to happen again later in the game, is that a drastic change in how you would view priorities for whom to target?
I think so. Yeah. So there's a quote later on when the Karma Six are having this powwow and thinking about who to vote out. And someone says, if you're playing Survivor and you have a chance to take out Joe, every time is the right time, which normally that is a fundamental axiom of Survivor, right? That's just, you can quibble about it in certain circumstances or whatever, but you can't really go too wrong by just taking your shot at Joe when you get the chance. I don't know if that's even true on this season. If it ever isn't automatic, this might be the season where you have to call that into doubt.
Right. Casual Anna's immediate reaction to seeing Joe voted out was, why would they vote him out when they know he's going to get a chance to just play a competition? Why not wait until after that's off the table? And the reason is that there's no point where that's off the table. And the like best case scenario is you have to beat him at an immunity challenge and at fire. So I think you are right that it is a massive kind of game changer. But to kind of go back to it, like, I think Joe in particular is going to be the biggest person for whom this is a concern. And obviously we have plenty to say about Joe and him finally being vulnerable later on. But
and,
I do think...
And yeah, the closest analog that we've seen in the past is Redemption Island, where there's not just one challenge, but a series of challenges. And if you vote out Joe at the merge instead of at Final 8 or Final 6, then in theory... whoever you send there next has a chance to win in some kind of upset and take down Joey Amazing ahead of time. Whereas this way, voting him out now versus voting him out later, assuming you get the chance, which maybe you don't, it's just the same thing, right? And there's almost a case for letting Joe stay in the game, forcing him to engage with that social and strategic element, which he's less skilled at than the challenges, where I think he's still a good social player and a fine strategist, but he is an all-time great at the challenges, and we know that's going to be in play, and so do all of them. And so the only question is, how do you engage with the other sides of that coin?
Right. I mean, I think there is an argument that could at least be made that voting Joe out now is, as he was kind of saying on his way out in his final words, like the biggest mistake they could have made. Like, yes, he loses his equity of running the table in challenges, which is probably what it would take to make it through the main game organically and get to the finals that way, and thus potentially loses some jury equity in that respect. But it's putting him off on the edge of extinction for 15, 18 days and he never has to vote anybody out of the game and then is guaranteed a chance to re-enter, potentially win a challenge or make a fire and then be in the finals with the people he's just spent the bulk of the game with providing for. As I said, I think a very serious argument could be made that even though he got voted out this week, Joe's equity just went up.
And that reaction from Joe, it's not just the usual tilting off that people do when they've been voted out, and of course whoever voted me out must be an idiot. It is actually legitimately puzzling why people would vote him out, which is a baffling thing that it is puzzling, right? Like, the idea that that's even in the conversation is bizarre, but it's a serious doubt to have. And yeah. I wonder now as well, is there a massive incentive to try and flood Edge of Extinction with people who could conceivably beat Joe in that final challenge? Because if he comes back, he only has to win that one immunity, that one individual immunity, for him to get to Final Four, where it then becomes that much harder to vote him out again. So I would be eyeing anyone who it seems like could steal that challenge from Joe, whether it's the puzzle masters of the world, or like if, you know, Rick won his way back before, maybe he can do it again. Like, knowing that you have this massive existential threat looming over the game, I think there's a strong case to just vote out as many challenge beasts as humanly possible. So you start with Joe, you then vote out everyone else, although maybe, like, if they're too good, they just start winning now because you voted out all of their competition. But you do what you can to make sure that Joe has a tough go of it in that challenge, because if you don't, then you may just never get another chance.
One thought that I had along those lines is the Erics and Gavins of the world must be quite happy that Chris is not one of the people who raised that white flag, and that he is still there as the person people can talk themselves into being able to hang with Joe in whatever physical element of the re-entry challenge comes up, instead of people potentially having thoughts along the lines of what you seem to be thinking, Dom, of we've got to start putting people on the edge of extinction who can potentially beat Joe. I think Chris being there is going to be a big weight off the shoulders of the bigger kind of challenge threats in the main game.
Yeah, let's talk about the raising of the flag quickly, because last week we speculated over how many people over the entire run of the season and of Edge of Extinction would end up quitting. And roughly, I don't know, 90 seconds before this happened on air in real time, you tweeted out something to the effect of, I guess this locks it in that no one's going to be quitting this season. And then it turns out we should have been taking the over on 0.5 for who would be getting in that boat and leaving before that time. But given that it was two people leaving, did it surprise you that it was those two in particular?
No, but this was so goddamn tilting, the timeline on how all of that went down, because it's something we've talked about in multiple recent podcasts, the idea of potentially no one ever quitting, just on the logic of if no one's quit yet and no one quits right after the reentry challenge, when is anyone ever going to quit? So the way it played out on TV is they do the reentry challenge. Jeff asks everyone, hey, anyone want to quit, or are you all going back to Edge of Extinction? They all raise their hand. They all are going back to Edge of Extinction. We go to commercial break, and now I'm catching up on Twitter and saying, hey, really starting to seem like no one's ever going to quit. If they didn't do it just then, who's going to quit down the line from here? And I started a poll of like, hey, public, take your pick, over under 0.5 quitters, poll length, 1 day, because of course this isn't going to be invalidated in the next 90 seconds. No one's quitting this week. We just established that. And then we get back from commercial break, and the very first fucking thing is that white flag going up.
Luckily, the turnaround time was so short that if you had just deleted it on the spot out of shame, I don't think that many people would have noticed.
So I did, hang on, let me pull this up. I don't remember the number, but I did screenshot as soon as the flag went up the mast. I wanted to see prior to that point what percentage of people had voted for under 0.5 quitters on the whole season, and I am desperately trying to stall for time and find this screenshot, but it was certainly the majority. Here it is. Certainly the majority. It was after the first 52 votes, which was 7 minutes into the poll, 62% of people said there would be zero quitters on this season, and 38% were at that point on the over.
And you saw those numbers shift precipitously over the course of the next 90 seconds?
They inverted pretty drastically over the course of the next 23.8 hours.
I hate it when spoiled people vote in my Edric polls, you know? It's just it's just poor form.
That's right. One other thought that I had just about Edge of Extinction, and now that it's kind of a known commodity, what it is within the game, the premise of people coming back in and everyone now knowing this is not done, this is going to happen again later, and also potentially the effect that's going to have on future seasons if this does become a semi-recurring thing. I don't want to be an alarmist. I know that that's not my style at all, Dom, but I have noticed that over the years on both Big Brother US and Big Brother Canada, which have really gone off the deep end in terms of twists and people just constantly re-entering the game who've been eliminated to such an extent that it almost just goes without saying from the beginning of the game. Everyone just kind of knows someone eventually is going to get a chance to return. And when that is common knowledge, and when it is common knowledge that crazy twists we've never heard of and we'll never know the rules to until they are right in front of our faces being used against us are just going to fall from the sky, that results in much more conservative gameplay when there are still a lot of people left. And I am nervous that the Edge of Extinction and things of that nature could have that same effect on future Survivor casts when they know just how unpredictable the producers want things to be. That really tends to make people default to the safer option that is definitely not going to blow up in their face.
Yeah, and this is the paradox that we've spoken about a few times now, where you might think that introducing all of these new, crazy, wacky elements into the game would make the gameplay itself more chaotic and more interesting, but it often has the opposite effect, where if you can't account for what may or may not be around the corner at any time, then it makes sense to make the player aware if it goes wrong, it can't go too wrong, and often that's going to involve, I'm going to stick with my big majority alliance, and we're just going to vote out the people on the other side, and then when we have the numbers, we'll just split the vote, because that's the way mathematically where nothing can go too wrong, and you'll just see that kind of mentality feed through over and over again, whereas when people know what the rules are, they know what they can push against and how to push the boundaries of those, and that's what makes things more interesting and keeps the game exciting.
Right. I feel like a good kind of snapshot of the possible future of Survivor players is at the very beginning of Tribal Council, as the whole big group is sitting there, Jeff says, all right, time to bring in the jurors. And I think it's Wentworth who gets subtitled, like, what the hell is going on? I feel like that could be quite often the case for these people who find themselves on future seasons now that it seems like advantages and things of that nature and twists are going to be sprung on people several times per season. And to tie it back to the genius, I think it's a testament to what they were able to do to have the audience constantly saying, oh my God, what a shocking result, without the players constantly being confused about what game they're even playing.
It was so jarring to see the jury members not in the usual Ponderosa glow-up mode, where instead we have Reem in the same disgusting outfit that she's had for the past 21 days, right? Like, it's just the visual of that was so bizarre.
The rural jurors, as I am calling them, which yes. is, if Dom, don't act like you've watched 30 Rock, but certainly
no,
for...
No, but I've seen you tweet out that exact joke before, so I was just laughing at the callback.
Yeah, so I tweeted that. Actually, everyone loves it when I talk about the things that I tweeted on Wednesday night. So one thing I tweeted, I was wondering, is this the first time we've ever seen jurors wearing buffs? And I was reminded of that original rural juror tweet that I sent out, which was Jenna in a buff on... Ghost Island, was it? Was that the season she was on? She was on Ghost Island getting voted out and then immediately being a juror with her buff on. But I believe that was at least one of the only times that we've seen jurors like this, and certainly the only time that we've seen jurors who still have a chance to get back into the game, right?
I want to see this go in reverse now. I want the jury members to be sprung with the decision of, okay, if you want to keep your spot on the jury, you now in your full, like, tribal council dress or whatever, have to go back to the edge of extinction and slam it there for the next 14 days. And, you know, if you want to quit, we'll take you back on the first flight to the US. But if you want to stay in the game, then this is what you have to do. You know, I feel like there's a lot of room to explore with this.
So stay tuned, I would say, for more of the Kelly Wentworth kind of reactions to seeing those jurors of people just totally thrown off by the same way I feel like Dan seeing his reaction to having his idol nullified, I think is another good example of just like where Survivor is headed.
Yeah, more truly heroic, authentic reactions here from Kelly Wentworth. Really just adding to her canon.
We stand. So, Dom... let's get into just these merge dynamics, and I gotta give my bad on this one. I thought, based on them going to so many votes together, and it seemed like establishing a decent amount of trust as kind of a unit, that this Lesu group, even though they were certainly down in the numbers compared to original Kama, would have kind of an edge in terms of feeling more loyal to each other. But it really seems like right away, this Kama 6 that we hear laid out by Ron of himself, Gavin, Eric, Victoria, Julie, and Julia are all really on the same page. And it's the Lesu group who can't wait to start taking each other out just to stay alive.
Yeah, and if you think that this Kama 6 is going to sit together for as long as it's going to matter, but if and when they start splintering, it'll be too late for you personally, then you really have no time left. You have to get this motley crew of everybody else together right now to go against them, because otherwise they're going to have at least 6 out of 12, and then soon 6 out of 11, and just an outright majority. So if you can get the Lesu 4 plus David and Rick plus Joe, and I guess Aurora seems to like Joe, so we'll just throw her in there too, then that gets you 7. That gets you what you need, but that is so unstable and requires so many moving pieces that it's not surprising that didn't come to pass.
I feel like it's also especially going to be relevant in these people's minds. I don't know what they got to see of David versus Goliath, if anything, but I believe they got to see Ghost Island and Game Changers, where the group that steamrolled the pre-merge, for the most part, did a good job of then steamrolling the post-merge. So I would imagine, even though for us viewers, we are coming on the heels of a somewhat chaotic season, that has got to be at the forefront of a lot of these players' mind, is the clock is really ticking now. It seems like such an OG kind of concept of one group pogonging the other, but honestly, in the last few seasons they'd seen, that'd been one of the more prominent storylines.
It would not shock me at all if Ron got Carled in the next few weeks.
Is that really fair to Ron to say he's going to get Carled?
Is it fair to Carl? Who are we doing dirty
here? I feel like Ron wouldn't... I don't feel like there's a circumstance under which Ron would get Carled, and I say that not having a very clear memory of how Carl was eliminated. I know roughly when he was eliminated, but it seems to me like Ron is a much different figure within this alliance than Carl was within the Davids.
Okay, I'll make sure to get the timestamp for that soundbite for future reference, but I know it doesn't have to be exactly that, but just something in that vein where maybe Gavin decides that he comes up with some crazy scheme that ends up getting too convoluted and backfires on him, or like Victoria decides it's time to make a move for herself, or that you can see that group falling apart and not just sticking together as a solid six until the very end. But it doesn't help that a lot of the more either experienced or unstable, or however you want to frame it, charitably or uncharitably, players are all collectively on the other side. So, you know, maybe Rick is going to go haywire, but he is just bundled in with the Lesu four for now, even though they voted for him again. It seems like they're going to be forced to be on the same side. Or we don't know what Kenny Wentworth has in mind. David knows his back is up against the wall and he needs to pull something out of the bag. Wardog is working on his bag of tricks as we speak, I'm sure. I'm sure he has designs on... He has grand designs on some future voter somewhere. And I don't want to give Lauren... I don't want to sell her short, but I'm sure she has ideas as well. So that group contains most of the more like forward-thinking or creative players, but they might be forced by circumstance to just work together in a fairly boring way for now.
So are you suggesting, because it sounds to me like what you're getting at is this comma group potentially splitting on themselves. I'm not saying you're calling it for next episode necessarily, but that would be their undoing potentially, or some of their undoing is one half of the group getting the jump on the other half of the group and that being the deciding factor. I would at this point be leaning more towards the combination of not just experience that the returning players have, but also the three, count them, three hidden immunity idols that the minority side currently has being the more likely undoing of this comma six.
Yeah, if they stop trying to blindside each other and end up working together, then that is a pretty fearsome roster of advantages that even if mathematically they're behind, we may get to the point where, like, there was just no way they can possibly play around three idols at the same time, even if they knew about them, which they don't at this stage. All of those are still a secret. And we are also getting into exactly the same phase that we were in Cambodia, where it seemed like Kelly Wentworth was out for the count, and then she sprung an idol and took out the leader of the opposing side. And we might be walking into just the exact same Andrew Savage script yet again.
Yeah, like I would say Ron getting savaged would be a much more apt parallel, potentially, with or without an idol, than Ron getting Carled in terms of being taken out as kind of the figurehead of that alliance once the minority finally gets a chance to get their way.
Well, the other thing as well is within that six, we have no idea who's working with who even likes each other, who even talks to each other. We have a vague sense that like Eric and Gavin are a pair. That's the most sure thing we can say. But what does Julie feel about Julia, or vice versa? Or who does Ron feel most loyal to? Does anyone actually feel loyal back to Ron? Like, we just don't know. So maybe we will have time to explore that when we get down to the six of them plus a few stragglers. Or maybe it's not going to matter because one of them is going to break away, and then that will kind of unleash this torrent of everyone else will break away too, and the Karma Six just won't exist as an entity anymore.
I would be so thrilled if it is the case that the storytelling team decided, hey, this comma group that in this timeline is going to go on to run the entire endgame is also not going to essentially go to any votes before the episode leading up to the merge. If they took more like the Australian Survivor approach and focused on the people who were relevant early when they mattered and were able to sit on some of the end game players for longer, more willing to sit on the end game players for longer and let them develop once their story becomes more important, I would very much love that. I think that would be a massive step in the right direction in terms of the way they frame the stories on CBS Survivor. Well,
as I recall, the Australian Survivor approach to storytelling is, because you have at least twice as much time to play around with, you just repeat the same things over and over and over again, to the point where it's not even foreshadowing anymore, it's just shadowing. And then by the time it finally happens, you're more relieved than anything else. You just want them to get it over with and just be done with it. So I hope we don't go quite that far in this direction, even if we could, which, based on how much they had to cram into this 42 minutes, I don't think that's even on the table.
Well, the good news is CBS isn't going to give them 27 90-minute episodes for a season anytime soon. But correct my math if this is wrong. We have our comma six on one side. We have Wentworth, Lauren, David, Rick, the War Dog on the other side, and Aurora still out there. What do you think about the prospect of those five? I know they've just been throwing votes all over each other, but do you think it is in play that they could try to bring in Aurora now that she's also, it seems, been scorned by this comma group, and this could be it in terms of ever having the numbers on that group again?
I guess, like, what else is she gonna do, and what else are they gonna do? Right, it seems.
Well, I guess I'm asking, do you anticipate this coming week being a bunch of returnees who have a ton of idols in their bags just pleading for their lives with the comma six again, or are you thinking there's going to be some sort of counterattack attempted?
I could see it going two ways, actually. So either you have these two factions within that lesser group. You have Kelly and Lauren on one side, and then David and Rick on the other, and they were already getting kind of sick of each other to begin with, and that's before they ended up voting for each other this week. So you might think if they think the Karma 6 is going to crack at some point, and soon enough that it's going to be useful to them, they might decide to join up with them. That would give them a majority to split the vote, get around any possible idol shenanigans, which they both have to be worried about from the other side, right? Like, if you're David, you know Kelly's history. You know she of anyone, is most likely to have an idol. And likewise, Kelly has to be worried that at least David, or maybe Rick, is going to have something in their pocket. So you could just join up with them, guarantee to make it through that vote, and then hope to bide your time and maybe peel off, let's say, the two people on the bottom of the Karma 6, and then flip that around at Final 9, let's say. Or if they are able to have this uneasy truce for now, they might decide, okay, if we can give the appearance of doing that, then that would be the perfect way to engineer Kelly pulls out an idol in exactly the same situation, or maybe David gets to be the star of the show this time, or Rick. So I could see either of those coming into play, but I don't know. What was your call here?
So if I was exactly Kelly Wentworth or Lauren, i.e. someone who knew about the two idols on our side and did not know about even having a third one, which would just be awesome too, but they don't obviously are not aware of that at this point, I would be strongly considering the possibility of trying to really rally the troops at this vote with 12 people left and try to get Lauren sold on the idea of, we need to go all in here and crack this group of six while we still can, and play both our idols and do everything possible to make our vote go this way, just because we may never get another chance. We certainly can't count on having another chance after this. Now, maybe the political situation is drastically different than it looks on TV, and that's completely out of the realm of possibility, and there are totally opposite priorities that need to be in place under these actual circumstances. But at least on paper, I would be very tempted to put in a big bet here, so to speak, on this vote, because it really seems like it could be one of the most important of the entire game.
So call your shot now. What do you think is going to happen?
I, at this point, would probably be leaning towards one of those comma six leaving this next episode. And part of that, admittedly, is just because of how much we've seen from the other side compared to the comma group. It seems like at least a couple of them are going to fall relatively soon. Like, that's not that bold of a call. But beyond that, I would say, just factoring in the experience and all of the idols that side has going for them, I could definitely see this being a premium spot for the game to take a major turn.
If it is one of the comma six leaving, is it one of the few that we've seen anything of, or could this be the time where, like, just a Julia just gets idled out seemingly randomly, and we have to try and make sense of it afterwards?
Maybe what they do is the comma six is still happy to take out Aurora. to kind of do yet another kind of Matt Elrodding and maintain a 6-5 advantage.
Yeah. Another subject of Matt Elrodding, that was something that was referenced obliquely this episode, where Julie thought it was just morally reprehensible that Kelly would even consider the idea of sending Rick straight back to the edge of extinction. And I remember similar reactions from a Julie 16 seasons ago now, when Rob decided just to send Matt Elrod back through that revolving door, because it seemed to them and to the rest of Zapatero like he was doing that just because he could, you know, he was just flexing rather than because it was actually the smartest move or the kindest move or whatever. That was him just showing his dominance. And I don't think there's quite the same power dynamic here, but you do have the same thing of Kelly's a returning player and she maybe is getting too big for her britches and she's power hungry or whatever. And if you've never spent any time with her before and you're only just meeting her now and she seems to have control of her tribe, it's very easy to write that narrative, right? Where she's just like this power hungry tyrant and anyone who poses any threat to her has to be chopped off. And so that maybe that's just Julie's impression. Maybe no one else shares that, but if that's the common understanding, then that could be what's dissuading maybe the Joes and the Auroras of the world from actually taking the plunge and going over there.
Yeah, it could be, but I think just kind of a general conundrum in Survivor is there, when you make a big move, honestly, more often than not, it's generally going to have some major detractors as well as people who think it was genius. The same way when Boston Rob did that, it's Julie Wolf was her last name, I'm going to go with. Unhappy about the ethics of it. And simultaneously, there's David Murphy realizing what happened and saying, oh my God, that was genius. And that kind of mixed reaction is the gamble, I guess, they have to like weigh when they're making these kind of, they're coming up with these kind of big ideas. But I would imagine, Dom, that Julie is more of an exception than the voice of the people when it comes to Wentworth being a bad person for considering the idea of wanting to take out
Rick. Are we meant to side with Julie as audience members? Like, are we meant to look at what Wentworth's doing and think, yeah, Julie really has a point here? Or is this just Julie being Julie? And we don't know what being Julie is, because this is literally the first we've seen of her all season. Whose side are we meant to take in that argument, even if it's not that explicit?
So I would imagine the casual audience primarily was meant to side with Julie.
Okay, because this is a narrative that we've seen with Kelly all season long, right? Where it has been either subtly or not so subtly pretty negative at times, but she has also seemed fairly just competent in the way she's playing the game. So is it meant to be like a grudging respect, or how are we meant to come down on that?
On whom?
On Kelly.
I would imagine, yeah, kind of a grudging respect, I suppose, or just people that saying Kelly's a bad person for wanting to take Rick out, I think is kind of exaggerating it, but the overwhelming sense I got is we were supposed to think Julie is right and for thinking Kelly is maybe, I don't want to say taking this too seriously, because obviously she's going to take it seriously when she's playing a game for $1 million, but I think we are meant to agree with Julie's interpretation that Wentworth is not weighing in the emotional element to the extent that she potentially should be. That would be the sense that I got. The same way, I wish I remembered who I saw tweeted this earlier. It may have been the wonderful Survivor Quotes X on Twitter, showing a screen cap of Rupert all the way back in Pearl Islands giving a confessional, and it was about how, oh, Burton wants to turn on one of our Drakes, and when he said that, I wanted to just smack him, and if this were a real pirate culture, he'd be dead by now. Obviously, considering the idea of eventually turning on people who happen to be on your same starting tribe is just standard, straightforward, good-thinking Survivor, but in that moment, the audience was clearly meant to and did overwhelmingly agree with Rupert.
And speaking of turning on people from your own starting tribe, we see the Karma Six eventually come to this consensus over voting out Joe, and the way this is sold to us is that Ron approaches Joe to scope him out, figure out what the deal is. Joe is deliberately vague with him. That spooks him. He runs back to the group, and then the vote switches, and that's what ends up dooming Joe. And the way that Survivor editing works, we always have to be given a reason. Except sometimes when they just throw caution to the winds and give us basically no idea what's going on or why. But most of the time, it follows the same kind of pattern. So it's easy to look at that and think, well, if only Joe had given Ron a name or been more reassuring, then he could have been spared this fate. But how inevitable do you think this was? So the moment that Joe fell off that platform, was he just doomed? He was dead to rights? Or was there anything he could have done, as far as you can tell?
I don't know for sure, but I would guess that that was, as it sounds like you're alluding to, Ron just kind of giving a reason for gunning for Joe. The same way I'm guessing if Joe had quickly given him a name, Ron would be giving a confessional about, like, oh, Joe couldn't wait to throw out Aurora's name or whoever it was. Like, that's pretty suspicious. I guess we better be on the lookout for Joe. I don't think there was much Joe could really do once people decide, oh, hey, Joe is finally vulnerable for the first time all game. There's just too much in the legacy of Joe Anglim that's going to encourage people to vote him out when that is the case, that it's almost out of his control. And we see him, I think, take what I would guess is a tactical approach to this situation and just hang out in the dead center of camp, painting the flag, barely talking to anyone to try to come across as little of a player as I'm guessing he would could.
Yeah, the painting thing might be subtle genius, because if you go up against Joe in a Survivor challenge, you know that you are heavily outmatched, to say the least. If you go to paint night with Joe, you at least, you know, there's a chance that your finished product might look better than his, even if it's unlikely still. He seems pretty artistic in his own right, but maybe this is just his own way of setting himself short and trying to minimize his own threat level.
Did you think that that was a deliberate decision, or was that Joe just... I don't think Joe is disinterested in what happens at the vote. I guess, what angle did you think Joe was making that decision from?
Maybe the man just likes to paint. I don't know. We might be reading too much into this.
I think there is an interesting discussion to be had about what Joe does and how, if he should be off trying to make things happen, or if it was potentially a good idea to just hang out and try to seem like the smallest threat you possibly can now that we're outside of the competition zone.
The problem is, the only other thing that you could make happen is getting that group of seven together and somehow all on the same page to turn the vote on the Karma Six, and that's just going to come down to whether Kelly and Lauren and David and Rick can actually trust each other again. And if they can't, you are not going to be the mediator that gets in the middle and comes up with a one-state solution for that, right? So it's going to come down to them, and you can't force it. And you being seen to try to force it is the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. So, I think if they are able to put their history aside and come together, they will come to you because they know they need you just as much as you need them. So yeah, maybe you do just sit in the middle of the camp and put some very nice looking artwork together and hope that things just work out.
Yeah, I think the idea of, I am probably not going to be the one who's spearheading a successful campaign in the next 2 hours, so my best bet is hope someone else is in the background spearheading such a campaign, hang out in the middle of camp where I am easily accessible if anyone wants to come find me, and hope that something like that comes in while no one's really considering me a person out there scheming. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was totally fine with seeing Joe just kind of hang out in the middle of the camp, even though I know that was a decision a lot of people took issue with. But we kind of glossed over, and by that I mean did not even mention, which we should have, during our time talking about Julie, that she is the one who is the first to win an individual immunity here, personal immunity here, excuse me. It comes down to she and Lauren and Joe, and Julie Amazing hangs on and stays unbeaten over the course of this season, Dom. I guess any thoughts on that, on seeing Joe? I know there was some talk of Joe like maybe giving up in this challenge. Did you see anything that could potentially point
to
that?
She is statistically the best challenge competitor in Survivor history now. There's no way you can argue with that.
I mean, isn't like Willard and Liliana undefeated? Aren't they both like undefeated in challenges?
Okay, but those are tribal challenges. Who knows how big a part they played in those? This one is all Julie. No one can take that away from her. Not even you, Colin.
True. So good job there by Julie. Amazing. And I assume you did not see anything or would not endorse the idea of Joe giving up at any point in this challenge.
It did look a little suspicious, but what he said at the end, I took that to mean like he was getting cramps in his legs or something. And he physically just couldn't continue, which would make sense. Like the one time you've seen Joe be taken out of a challenge before, it was against his own volition. Like I don't think we've ever seen him throw a challenge. I don't know if it's in his nature to be able to do that.
Let's get into, I guess, just the overall merits of taking out Joe here. If you are this comma six, and it seems like they did a really good job, by the way, of getting everyone in the minority to be scattering their votes all over each other, which is something I frankly haven't heard them getting what I feel like is enough credit for over the course of this week, is just what a clean job they did at splitting those votes and making sure their six votes on Joe would be enough. But let's talk about, I guess, in more detail, the idea of now that you have this clean look at Joe for the first time all game long, we're in a post-merge setting with individual challenges, but we know the Edge of Extinction is in play. What are the major pros, I guess, and cons, if you can come up with many, of actually taking this first shot at Joe here?
So I think the pro is you send him there now, you guarantee that you get to send him there now, and then, as I alluded to before, you just try and stack the Edge of Extinction with as many Joe-esque people as you possibly can and hope that the less threatening of those, you know, one of them will win the day. And that will be the way that you somehow dodge this Gordian knot, which it seems like is going to face you at some point, of just how do you get Joe out of the game? Like, it just doesn't seem that possible. If you think you may not get another convenient chance to take him out, then maybe you pull the trigger now, but he's going to lose one eventually, right? Or so you would think. And the prospect of Kelly being in the game, possibly with an idol, or David and Rick still being in the game, possibly with an idol, it feels like a lot more can go wrong if you don't play around that properly. And it's unclear how you could even play around that properly versus, at some point, Joe will lose again, and then you get to take him out, and that's fine. Although, as you said before, Joe is the type of guy who always finds an idol on Survivor, to the extent that in his previous season, even though he didn't have one, everyone just took it for granted that, oh, of course Joe has an idol, and we have to factor that into every single calculation.
Right, that would be a major consideration for me, is it seems like they do feel very comfortable that at least for the time being, Joe does not have an idol, and that is probably the deciding factor, I would say. And another major factor would be, is there really anyone else that we're dying to blindside right away? Because this would be the time to do it. But I could understand the comma six wanting to just nip Joe in the bud, at least to the extent that they can to this point, knowing they're going to have to face him down the line no matter what they do. Given the lack of super timing necessary blindsides that are seeming to be on the docket for these next couple of weeks, I would imagine the comma six feels better about their position without Joe in the game, given that they don't know just how many idols are on the other side. I feel like the idea of taking this six-person majority and going up against a five-plus Aurora with Joe out of the mix is certainly a very tempting option, at the very least.
And even if you think you're likely to get one more shot at Joe, getting two maybe is a much bigger ask. And going back to this thing of if you think he's likely to have an idol, that if that calculus is simple for you, it's when Joe loses, we're going to vote for Joe, then it's also simple for him. It's when I lose, they're going to vote for me, therefore I should play my idol. So the idea of like hoodwinking him into not playing it is harder than it might sound. So maybe it, even though it seems silly on the surface, like if you think we just don't have people who can outmuscle Joe yet, then we have one shot now, so why not just take it, right? And we can try and bob and weave around any hypothetical idol that may or may not exist when we get to that.
Yeah, so what do you think about this just being Joe's fate yet again? I can vividly remember, Dominic, the two of us talking the day the returnees were announced, before we even knew about the Edge of Extinction twist, and you making the point of not really understanding what the idea is behind bringing Joe back for a third time beyond just pandering to the casual fans, which is obviously a major consideration, but in game terms, it seems like pretty much the same thing is always going to happen to Joe, which is him getting taken out either right at the merge or very shortly thereafter. So now that we have seen that come into play, and obviously bearing in mind that the Edge of Extinction looms over the rest of the season, and that's going to be something we're not going to see resolved until the finale, Joe 3.0, if he is not the person who comes back in off the Edge of Extinction, was this a success or failure as far as you were concerned if you are production?
I guess it's a success in terms of what were you expecting? Like, we haven't seen anything new from Joe either as a player or as a character this season, and is that really surprising anyone? Like, you, if you're bringing back Joe, it's because you want more of the same. You got more of the same, and so mission accomplished as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a, yep, we have ticked that box off. One of your casual fan favorites is on this season. Don't worry, you can still tune in. And a couple years from now, maybe Malcolm will be back, and that'll be a lot of fun. Yeah, so there goes Joe, at least for now. Although, as mentioned, certainly not out of the woods yet. If you are anyone in the game, you still got to be worried about Joe re-entering and running the table. But hopefully we can put off that discussion for another couple of weeks, Dom. Anything else from you before we dive into the edit zone?
No, let's get into that.
All right. So this is the part of the show where we are going to get a little heavier into the way the story is being presented and the people are being edited, which I know is not everyone's cup of tea necessarily, or so I've been told over the years. So for anyone who wants to tune out and avoid that sort of thing, now would be the time to do so. And if you are one such person, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone, and you can email the show domandcolin@gmail.com. Here is your warning. Tune out now. We are in the edit zone, and Dom, we've got to start with the lead story from this episode. She's obviously come up in passing, but a larger discussion needs to be had about just how all over this episode Julie was.
Okay, Julie is not the lead story here. She, I'll let you say your piece, but I can't co-sign it, I'm afraid.
Julie is absolutely the lead story of this episode.
She may be the only story of this episode, but what does that mean in a larger context here?
I'm talking about just this episode. I feel like Julie, for anyone all season, has had the biggest spike between episodes that we've seen.
Okay, but there's a spike when you go from like a 4 to an 8, and then there's a spike where you go from a 0 to a 7, right?
And right, that's a bigger spike.
Okay, but it's a bigger spike because there was nothing there before to work with, and it's the contrast that's stark as opposed to the content itself.
So Julie was so dominating this episode's airtime that what?
No, I'm sorry, keep going.
Okay, I can't speak English that well. I'm sorry that my words aren't good. But Julie was just giving every confessional after the re-entry challenge for so long that when we came back from some commercial break and it was another Julie confessional, as much as I very much like Julie, I thought to myself, like, oh my God, are we going to hear from anyone else this week?
And we did. So I don't see what the problem is.
So who's the top story, Dom?
Well, look, there can be several tops story, Colin, okay? But
there can't. By definition, one must be the top story.
They can share the space on the front page. There's more than enough real estate to go around there. But look, I agree that Julie had a big episode, but I don't know if it was a big episode in an absolute sense or just a big episode for her, given that she and many other characters this season have had basically zero airtime up until this point.
So let me roll through for you what I've really thought stood out from Julie this episode, which is right away, she gives a confessional where she which includes the quote, "Edge of Extinction sounds like a scary place that I never want to go to," which to me could either mean she's going to go like next week, which I think is very much in play. I could easily see this being Julie's the next one out. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Or More likely, though, I would guess Julie is going to be one person who never ends up having to go to Edge of Extinction and is in there at least as an active player in the main game in the finale. I'm certainly not trying to say Julie is now necessarily even my front runner. I just think this was a huge week, and that quote really stood out. Also, we talked about earlier, her really, as far as I was concerned, coming across as like a champion for Rick, this poor guy who got voted out and then got magically brought back, and now everyone's targeting him again, so cruelly wanting to take him right back out where they sent him the first time. I thought she came across very sympathetic there. And then, crucially, Dominic, she got to mention her husband and kids at home right after winning immunity, and that to me is massive. If you will recall, during Ghost Island, I thought it was pretty much a toss-up between Wendell and Dominic, but we were hearing so little from Dom about his wife and kids back at home that I was giving the nod to Wendell just because of the treatment that Ben and Jeremy got, who were in remarkably similar situations to Dom, and we're talking about their family nonstop. I would say be on the lookout for Julie talking about her family at home. I think if that becomes a recurring thing, this stock is really going to soar. And then,
but you don't think Joe is actually going to do it for Sierra then?
Yeah. Hey, where was that call, Dom? What happened on that one?
Look, it's still in play. Joe can win his way back. Or actually, I've been thinking if they could take a page from Australian Survivor and have the loved ones come for some just to observe a challenge. And that might be the Edge of Extinction thing where they all get to come back in.
Or maybe they take a page out of Survivor Cagayan and just bring in loved ones with, like, Final Four, at which point Joe has re-entered.
Sure, which he's going to do, and then he'll win that, and then he'll win a Final Four, and then go and win the jury vote and win the season, and the world will rejoice, and everyone will be much happier.
Mm-hmm. But so to just kind of wrap up on Julie, one thing we've talked about just with the edit of the season is how potentially handcuffed the editors are if one of this comma group who did not end up going to any of the first five or six votes goes on to win the season and they want to be a little less overt about it than they've potentially been in some historical cases where that was the way the pre-merge went for the eventual winner. There's not a lot they could do prior to this merge episode to really show us too much from people. So for Julie to be the one that it seems like got way more of the focus than anyone else from that comma group that had been avoiding votes for so long, I really do think has to mean pretty good things for Julie, or again, very bad things for Julie insofar as her like leaving next week.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, are you a Julie truther? And if her edit continues to pick up, will you maintain that you've been a Julie truther this whole time and I just haven't been listening to you? Which could be true. I don't know.
I am a no one truther. I don't have the early episodes of this season I spent thinking Rick was my easy number one and then he got voted out. And I guess he's back in the game now. But I all season long, I have been I've had a hard time even ruling people out. I would say at this point, my only two completely just done chains, and done chain meaning like hard 0%, none of these Dom Harvey borderline done chains. I would say only Julia and Aurora are the people who would just blow my mind if they ended up winning this season. I feel like the other 10 are all at the very least in the mix. I would say like Ron and Gavin are probably near the bottom of that list for me, and maybe David Wright is starting to fall a bit, and Eric hasn't been as visible as I would have wanted him to potentially be if I was really invested in him as a potential winner. But other than Julia and Aurora, I would not at all be comfortable saying anyone else out of the other 10 is done yet.
You say the other 10. I would say the other 13. Do we think anyone who is currently on the Edge of Extinction still has a shot?
No.
I'm going to say Reem will not be winning this season of Survivor. Not this one, at least. Not making any promises for future seasons. Chris, I think, is out of the mix. Is Aubrey officially done? Have you hung the hanged hung? Has she acquired the done chain by now?
So, to me, yes. And it goes back to a distinction I made during episode like 2 or 3 where she was shown going from person to person on whatever tribe she was on, saying the exact same things over and over to try to get them on her side. And I think it is such a critical distinction between someone like Kelly Wentworth or like Lauren has been routinely this season shown with their back up against the wall versus being shown to be playing bad Survivor. And I think Aubrey was shown to be playing bad Survivor. And for me, that means she is done.
How dare you? But also, I can't disagree with you.
Yeah, I think that kind of distinction is something that goes tremendously overlooked in general in reading the story, but neither here nor there. Dom, who are you putting the Dom chain on, which is not really done, but close enough to done?
I would say maybe more of the Karma Six. I don't know if collectively they have this Upolu vibe going on where, despite getting less character development or just screen time in general than their opponents, they're going to end up winning the day, and one of them will take home the prize. I think among them, like, I can't see Ron winning. I think the chain is on him, the Ron chain, if you like. Gavin, what do you make of Gavin and Eric as a pair, actually, because they've been more visible than the others by a decent margin, but individually both of their edits still seem fairly lacking.
Yeah, if this were Australian Survivor, I'd feel a lot better about Gavin and Eric as a pair, but I do think they're both still in there from an edit perspective, despite how little we've seen. And maybe I should be lower on those two in particular, just given the way they tend to like to edit the kind of like alpha, maybe alpha's the wrong word, but like the heroic guys that go on to win the season don't tend to be minor characters for too long, to say the least. But I still feel like we've gotten plenty of, maybe not plenty, but some personal content from both of them, and they have both looked good pretty much across the board in what we have gotten to see of them. So while I do expect that plenty more Dunn chains are going to be hanged in these next couple of weeks as more time passes, and one would imagine that an eventual winner from the original Kama team would have started to emerge a bit more by now, I am, at least as of this week, still unwilling to go that far. And with a big episode next week, I could see either of them near the top tier of candidates. And that brings me, Dominic, to my next question, which is, if you're berating me for feeling like Julie had a big episode, I still haven't heard from you what the story of the week was as far as the edit's concerned.
Does that need to be one? Maybe it's just a slow news week.
It's just not Julie. It's just...
Yeah,
nothing to see here with Julie or anyone else.
That's the headline emblazoned in big bold letters. It's just not Julie. That's all it is.
Okay, I am not on board with that narrative, Dom. But that is a remarkably on-brand performance by you to berate me the entire time I'm making the case for Julie and then have absolutely nothing in mind for why that's not accurate. But
Okay, so I'll ask you about someone who slipped through the cracks of this discussion here, because we've spoken about everyone still in the game, and we spoke about the three people who were on the edge of extinction. How do you feel about Joe? Is he still in the mix at all? Because I know Carl's coming into this week was very high on Joe. I haven't traded in to see if he's still high on Joe. Maybe circumstances have changed a little bit since then, but do you see where he's coming from, and do you still see where he's coming from?
Yeah, I mean, as I think I said earlier, it is at least possible to me that Joe's equity actually went up after being voted out. And you are right. We are, I think, indeed remiss not to be still factoring Joe in as a very conceivable winner here, where all he has to do, it seems, is provide for people on the edge of extinction and then win a couple of challenges and at least be in decent enough shape, I would imagine, to at least have a couple votes with outs to get more. Now, maybe it will be the case that the jurors are of the opinion that kind of like fundamentalist Survivor fans, like probably you and I would be, of where once someone has been voted out, it's very hard to find a reason to eventually vote for them to end up winning the game. But I feel like at least an argument could be made that on the season that is called Edge of Extinction, and that's the twist that's been put into play here, that's as valid of a way to win the game as anything else. So why not? And with that in mind, honestly, who better than Joe to take advantage of this twist in terms of winning the challenges and being sociable enough and a good enough provider to curry enough favor with the jurors?
Yeah, I can't argue with any of that, even though I desperately want to. And that's what is starting to scare me here.
Yeah, I mean, I think Joe pretty much nothing has changed as far as I'm concerned in terms of his eventual win equity from last week, where I was assigning like 3 or 4 percentage points maybe to him running the table in the main game and winning that way, and the vast majority of his win equity last week was still coming through Edge of Extinction. So
yeah,
the...
if we were all absolutely confident that this exact fate would befall Joe. So if you thought he had a chance before, why wouldn't he still have a chance now? Like, what has actually changed?
No, exactly. So one question I have had though, Dom, is while there are a lot of people who are still very much in the mix for me, for sure, to be the eventual winner, I have been having a hard time placing a losing finalist to this point. Now, the losing finalist kind of conventional edit has changed a lot over these last few years, but I would say the one person who's kind of sticking out to me at this point, and I'm curious where you're landing on this, is I actually feel like Victoria could be more likely to be a losing finalist than a winning finalist.
Who do you think she is losing that finals to then?
I think it'd be any number of people, frankly. But
well, I ask because I can't really see her losing to one of the less developed members of that Karma 6. So if it's like Victoria, Gavin, and Ron or something, it would seem weird to me for anyone but Victoria to end up winning that. So maybe she sneaks in there with some of the lesser members or whoever comes back from Edge of Extinction, and that would be an interesting contrast. So I could kind of see that, but do you agree with that take, or do you think it literally could just be anyone?
I think it could be pretty close to anyone, but I am on board that actually of the Karma group, I would say maybe Julie at this point would be the most likely person I could see her losing to, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if it ends up being like Lauren or Wentworth or something like that either. I could see them linking up and going to the finals together.
Okay.
Hashtag stop thinking about Women's Alliance is dumb.
how do you feel about those Lesu for them? Because I would say any of Kelly, Lauren, David, or Rick, maybe David a little bit less so, but he's still certainly in the mix. Any one of them I could see as a plausible winner.
100%. And what about the War Dog?
I'd say the jury's still out, but I don't think they are. I think War Dog is done.
I am nowhere near done on the War Dog. I think he got a lot of really strong stuff during the pre-merge. It's been a quiet couple of weeks, but as I've said many times over the years, if there's a time to go quiet, it's right before the merge when you're not going to all the votes. So still definitely in on War Dog as a conceivable winner as well. And it just, like, I want to go back to just the kind of bigger picture idea of having so many people still drawing live for me. And I know maybe I am more inclined to keep believing and not wanting to rule anyone out before I feel like it's a hard 0%, but I feel like every single season at this point in the game, year after year now, we are, or season after season now, we are arriving with more and more people drawing live for longer into the game. And I think that is such an incredible thing for the overall Survivor product to have the vast majority of people in the cast still be conceivable winners at this point.
What are your thoughts on your girl Kelly Wentworth at this point? Because she has had certainly a big edit, and the kind of edit that you would expect from a returning player. Like, it's certainly more developed than some of the others, but is it a good edit? Is it one that's pointing in the right direction if you're a Kelly Wentworth fan?
So I'm still pretty sold on kind of the inverse of what I was explaining about Aubrey earlier and them making her look like an actively bad Survivor player. Maybe this is recency bias because of how Nick was treated last season on a season explicitly called David versus Goliath, but both Lauren and Kelly seeming, or at least being made to look to have survived narrowly a couple of times during the pre-merge while overcoming that, and now having idols in their pocket and potentially being able to flip things soon in the timelines where they do go deep, I would think that kind of wanting to make it look like it was a close call early, ultimately leading to this amazing comeback, is exactly the story they would want to tell. And thus, I think I am still at the point this week, much like last week, where Lauren and Kelly Wentworth in some order are still my top two.
Okay, how do you feel about Lauren then? If you're having to compare the two, where does Lauren stack up for you?
So it's, I have a hard time differentiating, like conclusively putting one too much higher above the other, just because Kelly has been more visible and we're hearing more from her, I think, in confessionals. But Kelly's also a returning player, and that I think is going to bias the way that she is presented compared to someone like Lauren, who's playing for the first time. So to me, that's really just a wash in terms of how they're being presented. And the only other people that I would say I really have on that tier at this point would be Rick. I can't shake the idea of Rick potentially going on to win this season. And actually, I think Rob or Steven made a really good point on the Know-It-Alls, that it seems like the producers or editors and everyone involved really likes it when the winner is the embodiment of the theme of the season, the way Nick was for David versus Goliath, or Sarah Lucina was such a game changer with her aggressive approach, and things of that nature. For Rick to be the guy who comes in off the edge of extinction and wins Edge of Extinction, I think would be a story they would like to see happen and enjoy telling along the way. So Rick would be on that tier for me. And then after this week, I really am, I can't stop myself from putting Julie in that top tier after she finally gets some exposure now that she's part of the main game to speak of.
I agree with that point, and that argues to me against someone like Lauren, who thematically it really seems difficult to tie her into the Edge of Extinction or really to build any kind of coherent story around what she's doing other than just playing pretty good, solid ABC Survivor.
They really struggle with telling the winning stories of the Laurens of the world who have gone on to win Survivor.
Yes. That's how you get these bizarre outliers like the Michelle Fitzgeralds, where you either see it coming from a mile away or you get completely blindsided by it.
Right. That's right. And that's why Lauren, to me, while it is an extremely unconventional kind of possible winner edit, given her demographic, I don't think it's off the table at all.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then I do still believe in War Dog and Eric and potentially David and Victoria in that kind of next tier. And I'm going to leave Ron and Gavin kind of hanging on for me. But Dom, who are your top contenders? Who's your number one right now?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that.
You were so, like, the Dom Harvey experience is being, like, assaulted for having an opinion about a question you asked and then asking that same question of you and being told you don't even care one direction or the other.
I get that a lot, yeah. So I would say my top tier, I don't know what I think about Kelly's edit, but it's hovering around the top for me. So it's either top tier or just the next tier down. Then I would put Rick up there as well. It seems like it really has to be one of that lesser four. And so I would have, I guess, David in the bottom of that group. And I think Lauren would still be near the top, although I'm not sure what to make of this episode. I don't know if it was good that she took more of a low profile while everyone else was going crazy around her, or if, because it's a merge episode, you would expect her to play a bigger part in that. But either way, I think even if you take the negative view, it's not enough to write her off or really knock her down that far at all. So she would still be pretty far out there for me. And then off the others, I think Joe is still in the mix. He's somewhere in there. But that's, I guess, kind of Victoria too. But that's really it for me. I think it has to be those lesser four. And I think I'm just solidly planting my flag there.
And by lesser four, it seems like you are repeatedly swapping out War Dog for Rick.
Oh, yeah. As I am wont to do.
Okay, so you hate War Dog and should be blocked on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm surprised I'm not already, to be honest.
I check like every week to make sure that I'm still good.
I'm offended that I haven't been blocked yet. If you're out there, War Dog, just do me a solid, okay?
Don't do it. Dom, why do you do this to yourself?
Do what?
This is, okay, so this is hashtag date this podcast, March Madness, the Final Four has just been established, and Dom, your bracket, I thought, was such a perfect kind of just embodiment of, once again, of just the Dom Harvey experience of, much like begging War Dog to just block you in advance, even though you haven't done or said anything that would lead him to want to do so, at least that I know of, is a lot to me like you submitting your March Madness bracket by just using a random number generator. It is the move of, hey, if I don't put in a sincere effort in the first place, I can't be judged for performing.
How am I meant to put in a sincere effort when I know nothing about basketball? Like, I would only make even more of a fool out of myself. Whereas this way, I at least can play along with a bit, and I have, like, plausible deniability when I inevitably fail horrifically. Like, what would you have me do instead, Colin?
Look, do the same thing I do. Here's a fun fact. We watched the exact same amount of college basketball this year, which is zero. So,
You talk about it with a much greater fluency than I do. Let's put it that way.
My move is every single year when the bracket comes out, 538 does their March Madness odds with like an interactive bracket thing where you can scroll over every team and see their odds of advancing to every single round and winning the championship. And you pick mostly the teams that have the better chances and then sprinkle in some upsets, Dom. And that's my formula every single year. And it works out pretty well.
Well, what if it doesn't mean as much to me as it apparently does to you?
It just struck me that all you have to do is pick like pick higher seeds instead of going to a random number generator. At least put in something that could conceivably win.
Look, if it would mean a lot to you for me to put an effort in, then next year I pledge I will do my homework and I will take it seriously.
I believe it when I see it. Yeah, I need you to be watching hardcore college basketball all season long, or else I'm going to be unsatisfied.
I can't promise to do that, but I can promise to pretend to do that, if that would make you happy.
All right. Dom, who's your pick to win it all?
I believe I still have Duke, which seems like a fairly safe pick. The Kansas versus Kansas State showdown that I had for the Final Four did not materialize, shockingly. So I'm left scratching around for something else.
Unfortunately, Duke was eliminated about 6 hours ago. So much for that pick.
Well, now I have no idea what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. Well, just for the record, we're rooting for either of Texas Tech or Auburn, because in either of those cases, I will win my bracket pool for the first time in my life, and that would make me be very excited.
I'm just shocked you haven't insisted I pronounce Auburn yet. But there it is.
I like it. It's solid. I named my bracket because I was so reliant on Auburn going deep. I named it Auburn Bracco.
You named it that just for the pun, didn't you?
Yeah. It's hey, worse strategies have been employed by hosts of this podcast. So Dom, what else this week?
I really don't have anything else, I'm afraid.
All right. I think that will do it for me as well. One more time. He is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. We are, of course, as always, rewatching classic CBS and other potentially other network seasons down the line, maybe. So far, just CBS. But over on patreon.com/DomandColin, weekly bonus episodes currently right now talking through Survivor Fiji, but getting near the home stretch there. So something new on the horizon in a month or two. Until next week, I think that's going to do it. We will talk to you after the thrilling 12-person vote in episode 8. Until then, take care, everybody.